Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to FedSoc Forums. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I'm an Associate Director with the Federal Society's Practice Groups. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speakers and not of the Federalist Society. Today's Courthouse Steps program will be a discussion of the recent unanimous decision from the Supreme Court in First Choice Women's Resource Centers, Incorporated v. Davenport. Joining us to discuss this important decision, we have Teresa Stanton Collette, Professor and Director of the Pro-Life Center at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, and Casey Maddox, Vice President for Legal Strategy at Stand Together. If our audience has any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen and not the chat, so we'll be able to access them later in the discussion. With that note, I will turn things over to our speakers to start today's conversation. Casey, I think you're starting us off. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Well, thank you all for joining us. Thank you, Libby, and to FedSoc for hosting this conversation. So the decision on Wednesday in First Choice was a unanimous decision from the Supreme Court. And this is the, it's essentially a standing, I mean, maybe you can kind of think about it as a standing and principally a standing decision, but also a First Amendment decision as well. And so I'll give you the quick background and then and a little bit of thoughts and then turn it over to Professor Collette. But basically what happened is you had the Dobbs decision. And after the Dobbs decision, then a number of states and the Biden administration began sort of looking for what can we do to, you know, to sort of respond to this. And one of the things that that New Jersey did was to create what was called a reproductive rights strike force. And so their reproductive rights strike force included sending a consumer alert about pregnancy centers in New Jersey. And that consumer alert basically said it's possible that donors to pregnancy centers, pro-life pregnancy centers in New Jersey, may have been confused and thought that they were giving to organizations that do abortions. And they cited as evidence for this, as the opinion points out, pictures of families with babies. It doesn't make any sense to me either, but that's what they that was the evidence that they cited. So so basically the idea was your donors may have been confused. So they sent a subpoena to First Choice Pregnancy Center and said, we need the list of your donors and their addresses and their phone numbers and their employers, because we want to pick a representative sample of your donors and contact them and see if they knew that they were giving to a pro-life pregnancy center and not to an organization that does abortions, sort of confirm their theory. And so we're from the government. We're just trying to help your donors make sure that they are that they're giving to the causes that they think that they're giving to. There were no complaints against the pregnancy centers. That was confirmed at oral argument that they had received no actual complaints from anyone about these. So First Choice then, represented by Alliance Defending Freedom, First Choice files. So this is in the subpoena has been sent. First Choice files a lawsuit in federal court on First Amendment grounds, trying to protect their donors and trying to stop the Attorney General, enjoin the Attorney General from enforcing the subpoena. The Attorney General then sues in state court, demanding that the state court enforce the subpoena against against First Choice. The federal court says essentially there's no standing here. There's no standing because all you have at this point is just this subpoena. And the subpoena doesn't really mean anything until it's actually enforced by the state court. And so you have to wait basically until the state court says, no, 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 you really do have to respond to the subpoena. Of course, the subpoena itself says, you know, if you don't comply with the subpoena, then there are all kinds of penalties. that will follow. But the federal court says you have to wait until the state court actually enforces the subpoena for that, for the burden to actually occur. And so that's kind of the background on how this case moved up. Was basically the dismissal of the complaint, denial of the preliminary injunction. Third Circuit affirms that and says, we don't have a burden at this point, just based on the existence of the subpoena being sent to you. So that's kind of where we are. So before I get into the opinion itself, Professor Collette, I'll stop for a moment there and turn it over and see if you've got some opening thoughts, either on sort of how we got to this moment or what the court said.
So thank you, Casey. And I also am very grateful to be able to work with the Federalist Society on this program. What I find interesting, and found interesting even before the opinion came out or the oral argument, is the lineup of folks that filed amicus briefs in the Supreme Court. On the side of the Pregnancy Resource Center, you would find your usual suspects, other pregnancy centers, Heartbeat International, CareNet, et cetera. You'd also find organizations that are typically found on conservative and pro-life cases. But in addition to those, you see like the Chamber of Commerce filing a brief saying that you've got to be able to go into federal court. This makes no sense to us, sort of thing. And so at the end of the day, there were 23 different amicus briefs, which, given the state of litigation today, I guess that's not an extraordinary number, but it's still an interest. The breadth of it is just fascinating to me. And of course, the United States filed on the side of the Pregnancy Resource Center. On the other side, you have three lonely amicus briefs that want to talk about primarily the importance of federalism, primarily the importance of, you know, state investigations. And if you allow this to go forward, then what you're doing is you're basically crippling the state attorneys general. And I'm in a state where our attorney general literally on his website pleaded for women who had gone to pregnancy centers, please come tell me a bad story so I can investigate them. And of course, we were part of that amicus brief in this proud state of Minnesota. So it's fascinating, though, that this case garnered the attention even of organizations like the Chamber of Commerce. That's what I find interesting.
Yeah, and I think the court, ends up pointing to the amicus lineup to help confirm this point that, basically people across the ideological spectrum recognize that when you've gotten a subpoena like this from an attorney general, the demanding your donor information, the burden starts then, not at some later date when you figure it out, right? Or, you know, when some court tells you, no, really, you must do this immediately, right? That the demand from the AG starts to impact that. And so so in this case alone, you had FIRE, the ACLU.
I should
acknowledge that I'm on the FIRE board now. But you had FIRE, the ACLU, ACLU of New Jersey, NetChoice, that does, you know, does a lot of work in the with social media platforms, because all of those are areas where there have been sort of demands by AGs or by governments, blue or red, making demands of people. And so they recognize that, look, this has implications for us. They also pointed back on the sort of donor privacy point. So the Americans for Prosperity Foundation versus Bonta case comes up a lot here, and we had that case at AFPF. The amicus lineup there, they point to the amicus, reference the amicus lineup there. And I've said before, I've never been in litigation on the same side as the Human Rights Campaign, PETA, just a whole litany of organizations that all recognize that exposing our donors to government demands is a burden on First Amendment rights. And so this is sort of a unique area, I think, where people across the ideological spectrum have recognized that there's a real problem with turning over your donors. So the way the court ends up addressing that is to say, you know, so you have the injury in fact requirement for standing. That's the core question in the case. And that the court says when a defendant burdens a plaintiff's, basically that injury occurs whenever a defendant burdens a plaintiff's constitutional rights, not, you know, not when when it has sort of tangibly harmed you, but when it's burdened. And so demanding disclosure itself has that burdening effect. And that's because basically both the affidavits here to this point, but it's probably self-evident and confirmed by all the amici that, you know, as soon as you start making those demands, then donors have to look at the reality that, well, if I give to this organization, the best we can say is that maybe my name and my employer's name and all of my contact information won't be turned over to the government. But I don't know that for sure. And so that's a burden in itself, that burden on associational rights. And then from the organization's perspective, obviously it makes it much more difficult to try to recruit those donors if you have to say to them that I can't promise you that I'm not going to turn your name over to the government. And particularly in a case like this, an attorney general who has created a reproductive rights strike force and has a very aggressive attempt to try to advocate for abortion rights. And so that's the concern.
And recall, we're not that far away from when the proposed, I think, chairman of Oracle had to step down because it was revealed that he had donated in California to a marriage when the definition of marriage was at issue right. in the courts. And so there are very real consequences to people. And it seems to me that in the briefing, the Attorney General of New Jersey tries to argue, well, you know, I agreed to keep it confidential and I backed off on part of it. But I did reserve the right to, you know, come back and ask for it later. And the court basically said that does not move the case out, counsel. And it recognized that even if there was a sincere effort of the Attorney General to keep that information confidential within its office, the simple fact is there are too many ways that information leaks, especially from government agencies, it appears.
And we had that situation that occurred in AFPF Ibanta. There were leaks of information that had happened in California where the, you know, despite the promises of confidentiality, it leaked anyway. And of course, fundamentally, I think that one of the last lines in the court's opinion sort of says, look, even if we assume all of that, even if we assume you have a protective order that perfectly protects this information and everybody complies with it, one of the last lines is, would it have been an answer if in NAACP v. Alabama, if the state's AG promised to keep the NAACP's membership roles to himself? And the court doesn't even answer that question. It's a rhetorical question for a unanimous court that sort of just leaves it hanging. Obviously, no, it wouldn't have been enough. And so, you know, that was basically the decision in AFPF Ibanta too. They were trying to say, well, we'll just keep this information to the AG. The court seems to completely dismiss that as this doesn't eliminate the problem. So the AG has a couple of other arguments that they try to make, the AG tries to make to try to defend its position. One itself says, well, look, these subpoenas aren't self-executing. The subpoena itself just relies upon a court to actually enforce the thing. And it's a great quote from Justice Gorsuch in the opinion. The value of a sword of Damocles is that it hangs, not that it drops. Just a fantastic line. It's actually quoting a prior Supreme Court decision, but one that I had not recalled before. And I expect we will probably see that among other lines in this opinion that will sort of be much more frequent now in First Amendment law going forward. But the point being that the burden occurs at the point that you are sort of under the threat of government enforcing this thing. You don't have to wait until down the line, until the government has actually taken something from you before you can ask the court to weigh in. So there's that.
The New Jersey Attorney General's strongest argument, which ultimately does not carry the day, nor do I believe it should have carried the day, but I do think his strongest argument was that relief can be obtained through state courts, and that, and in fact, now in this instance, it was the AG who went to the state court, but that plaintiffs in these cases would have access to that. And basically, the court says that if we accept that argument, 1983 goes out the window, because there's no point in 1983. We could have waited for the state courts in all of those other cases, and then they could come into the federal jurisdiction. But I did think that was the strongest argument. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that was, I mean, that's how they got to this point, was basically trying to, you know, they had won on that argument, essentially, that like, well, right. Look, you can just go to state court and then work it out. Of course, the other problem. So one, it's the 1983 problem, right? But that's the whole point of 1983, is that you get to go to federal court to enforce your First Amendment rights. You don't, and any other constitutional rights, you don't have to go through the state court process first and then get to federal court. And then the other problem was this preclusion trap, because, you know, the real challenge there is that, I think a lot of people would think like, well, but just go through the state court process first, and then eventually you can get to federal court. But it doesn't work that way, because if you have to raise the First Amendment defenses in state court, if you just sort of said to New Jersey, well, we'll see you in court when you try to enforce the subpoena, and you raise your First Amendment defenses there, you'd have to raise them. But then once you've done that, then you have a res judicata problem, that once the state court has actually made a decision on your First Amendment rights, you can't go back to a federal district court and say, okay, well, we lost on this argument over there, but I'm going to repeat the same arguments here and ask you to undo that decision. So your only option, and some of the amici, or at least one of the amici from the other side, tried to make this argument that like, well, but the federal courts remain open, by which we mean you can file a cert petition after you have lost at the New Jersey Supreme Court on your First Amendment argument, right? And so for anyone who litigates at all and ever asks the Supreme Court to weigh in, it is a very small hope to say, well, but the good news is you can file a cert petition after you have lost all the way up in the state court process, and you can file a cert petition asking the Supreme Court to weigh in. At that point,
especially from the state Supreme Court, as opposed to having a federal split in the circuits, or
tiny chance of success. Exactly. Right. So and again, that's 1983 exists for the purpose of allowing people to vindicate federal constitutional rights in federal court,
because and the state courts weren't working at the time it was passed. I mean, that's part of the problem, is the bias that you can see in some state courts on some issues. Right. So and then
So that argument, I agree with you. That's the argument that they had succeeded on, and that argument is up failing. The other argument that New Jersey tries to make is that, we'll tell you what, we'll only seek donor information from donors who give to this group of websites, and there's one website that we won't seek donor information from. If they gave through that website, you're fine. And so, therefore, since we're leaving donors the opportunity to give through that website and not have their information, sent to the disclosed to the AG, then your rights have not been violated. And there's a line. This one is not a quote. This is Justice Gorsuch's own, and expect this to start popping up whenever government tries to make we're allowing you to exercise your rights over here, so stop complaining that we're burdening them over there. He says, a government that takes three limbs but spares the last imposes an injury all the same. I think you will see First Amendment litigators making that argument with frequency now against arguments that, you know, well, look, we're de-recognizing your student group, but you're still allowed to be able to, hold your meetings, just not officially, or no, we're not allowing you to use this forum, but you can still do your First Amendment stuff over here in a different forum. And so, no harm, no foul. That's, I think, will be the response to that argument going forward.
At the heart of it, it really does seem like the Attorney General saw this as a largely, if not primarily, a procedural case. And the Resource Center saw it clearly as a substantive First Amendment case. And the court overwhelmingly, before we began our program, you were noting that some of these statements are really strong, and yet we have, you know, Justice Sotomayor signing on, and we have Justice Kagan signing on. So there is a unanimity here that gives me hope.
No, it's very hopeful. I mean, the fact that this is a unanimous opinion, and it reads like an opinion that you would have expected to be a 5 or 6 justice opinion on some of these First Amendment points. It's just very clear and sort of uncompromising in a lot of ways. The third argument that the AG makes is that, well, look, the day before oral argument in the Third Circuit, I contacted the counsel for the Pregnancy Center and said that I was open to narrowing the requests.
Right.
And so since I was open to narrowing the requests, then that basically mooted their case. And it's essentially a government cessation argument that, since we ceased violating your rights the day before the oral argument in the Third Circuit, then, you know, you really
Nothing to see here. Just move
there's,
on.
There's no problem. And the court deals with that pretty quickly and says, that's just that's not how it works. That's not how any of this works. You don't get to government can't just sort of announce one day, on second thought, never mind, we won't bother continuing to violate your rights. It doesn't kind of function that way. And even then they were still saying, but we do still have 2 websites that we want your donor information from. So it did not answer the moment there. If you do have questions, please feel free to drop them in. Larry Joseph points out in federal courts, you can appeal the denial of interim relief and then apply to the Supreme Court for a stay. By contrast, you need a final state court judgment from a state Supreme Court to get to the U.S. Supreme Court at all. And so, again, sort of making the point that the idea that, well, you can just sort of go through the state court process, that would be, it's kind of a good evidence of the process is the punishment sort of problem.
Absolutely.
Part of the whole point here is to avoid for the, you know, the burdened party to avoid, you know, 3 years worth or more of litigation to be able to get to the vindication of their rights. And if you can go to federal court and get an injunction, you can do that. You can make this a 2 or 3 month problem that you've had to deal with. If you have to go through the state court process and then get to the Supreme Court, you're looking at a 3 year or more process.
And all the while, prospective donors are worried about it.
Yes,
and so not only are you bleeding money to lawyers, bleeding money for litigation costs, but you're seeing your revenues go down because donors are concerned about the impact on either the public perception or their company or whatever. So
yeah,
it's the court got
And again, this case comes up in the context of a pregnancy center in a blue state, right? And so the temptation from, the New York Times, of course, reports this case as, Supreme Court sides with anti-abortion, the center. And you'll see some of that from, some of these other kind of publications. But again, it's a unanimous decision, and it's one that drew, and it's kind of the broader issue, has drawn amicus support from people from all kinds of different perspectives. Because it's very easy to imagine if you are a, you know, if you're a an LGBT organization in a town in you know, in a much more red state, that the shoe looks like it's on the other foot, and you understand pretty quickly why these sorts of demands to your organization would, you know, immediately cause people to want to think twice about, you know, continuing to contribute to your organization. So if you have to go 3 years before you can get to a court, your organization may not exist at the end of that 3 year period, because people just, you know, I'll give to other causes that are similar, but I'm not, there's no reason for me to continue to, you know, expose myself here. So,
and we've seen that happen to prominent folks whose their contributions have become public. So it's important, and it is encouraging, again, to me. Not only is the court opinion encouraging, the broad support that the plaintiffs had in this case is really encouraging to me.
Yeah. No, that's very true. And again, I've said before that in the AFPF case, we had probably what I thought was maybe the most diverse set of amicus briefs in any actually contested constitutional case that I had ever seen. And the court here points back to that reality in that case and to the amicus briefs that were filed here to sort of make that point that, look, this is not a red-blue question. Basically, anybody who is involved in public life recognizes this. We also had examples, I'll note too, in the AFPF case, of organizations that were completely outside the political universe, right? You had ballets and zoos and all sorts of other people who basically were just making the point that, like, look, we have donors to our ballet in, you know, northern Wisconsin or whatever it was. It would be really bad for us if those donors were publicly released, because then other development people will know that this is a guy who's giving to a ballet in northern Wisconsin. I wonder if they'd be interested in our ballet in southern Wisconsin. And so, you know, that's, even if you have zero political valence to your organization at all, anybody who is collecting contributions from people knows that you want to make sure that your donor privacy is protected and that people have the ability to associate with you without, you know, having that information kind of broadcast. So
I think the strength of this in protecting donor lists, I also think, you know, the way they look at 1983 is very important, because there is, as we're seeing, there are important policy questions that are being presented to courts all the time. And we do need some uniformity, at least on that and the procedural aspect. Where can we go for help, and how quickly can we get the help we need? So I see Libby's rejoined us.
Well, I just had to jump in at the tail end of that great discussion. But if we don't have any more audience questions, I just wanted to come back in and thank you again both so much for joining us. That was a wonderful discussion. Again, a fascinating decision. And yeah, thank you both so much for jumping on so soon after the decision was announced, for sharing your expertise and opinions. And if our audience is interested in learning more about all of our programming here at the Federalist Society, please visit our website at fedsoc.org. That is FEDSOC.org. Or feel free to send us your feedback. We always love to hear it at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.